Well, good Sabbath afternoon, brethren. It's good to see everyone again. In just about a month, actually just under a month, we will be celebrating the sacred season of the seventh month. It's time for us to begin to examine our thoughts and our attitudes and to consider, are we in the proper state of mind to appear before the King of the Universe? I'll ask that again. Are we in the proper state of mind to appear before the King of the Universe? If you'll turn with me to 2 Corinthians chapter 10, we'll begin reading there in verse 3, and we'll just consider some thoughts from the Apostle Paul here. 2 Corinthians 10, beginning with verse 3. And we read here, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but eternally powerful for the destruction of fortresses." Some translations say strongholds. "We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of Yahweh. And we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Messiah." It says that we're destroying speculations and taking every thought captive to the obedience of the Messiah. Let's consider that for just a minute. The word speculations might also be translated as imaginations or reasonings or thoughts. How are we doing, brethren, with our thought lives? Do we think about the right kinds of things? Are we concerned with worldly and sensual things rather than spiritual things? Are we more concerned with temporal success instead of spiritual success? These are all questions that we must answer to ourselves and before Yahweh. It says that we have to take every thought captive to the obedience of the Messiah. In other words, we must have the mind of the Messiah. Whenever we do things, whenever we think things, what we need to do in each of those cases is to ask ourselves, what would Yahshua do? What would his mind be about this particular topic, about this particular thought, about this particular action? And we always have to filter our lives through the mind of the Messiah. And if you want to know the mind of the Messiah, you don't have to guess what that mind is. You look into the scriptures, and certainly you could look at the evangels and the words that came out of his mouth, which came from his heart. In that way, you could certainly know the mind of the Messiah. But in point of fact, Yahshua is the living word of Almighty Yahweh, and reality is embodied in the entire sacred scriptures. So if you want to know the mind of the Messiah who said that he came speaking not his own words, but the words of his Father who sent him, and doing the will of his Father who sent him. If you want to know his mind and you want to know his will, then all you have to do is look in the pages of the sacred scriptures from Genesis to Revelation, and you're going to know the mind of the Messiah. And then it's important to take that mind and to seek to do the same thing. And that way we can take every thought captive to the obedience of the Messiah. The title of this message is Attitude Adjustments. Very simple. Attitude Adjustments. What kind of attitudes do we have presently? And what kind of attitude will we have when we appear before Almighty Yahweh during the holy days, during the sacred season? What is attitude anyway? Well, if you want a dictionary definition from Webster's Dictionary, you have several here. One of them might be posture, what the attitude that you take. It's posture, it's a noun. But the one I really want to consider is the second definition here, which is the one that we typically consider when we think of the word attitude. The word attitude means a mental position or feeling with regard to a fact or state. I'll repeat that. A mental position or feeling with regard to a fact or state. And as I said, I'm especially interested in this second definition. What is our mental position? What is our mental feeling with regard to the fact or state of our current existence? And that may be different for everyone because you have your own experiences. You have your own set of circumstances that you have to deal with in your life. I can't speak for you and you can't speak for me. Although we may see some similarities, although we may see some commonalities, the fact remains that your life is yours and my life is mine. And it's going to be different for everyone. And within a family, even in that case, you might still have similar thoughts and attitudes and actions because you belong to a tightly knit group of several people in the same vicinity. But even in that case, because each one of us is an individual, we have our own way of dealing with things, and those are shaped by our education, by our history, by our background, by our upbringing, by the way that we reflect upon things and deal with things and have done so in the past. Are they positive attitudes these mental positions or feelings with regard to our existence. Are they positive? Are they negative? Sometimes one, sometimes the other. And sometimes there's a mix, right? It's up to us to know how we react to the things that happen in life. And it is up to us how we react to the things that happen in life. What do I mean by that? We don't always have, as if I have to tell you this, we don't always have control over everything, my friends. We cannot control everything in this life. Let me give you some examples over things over which we have very little or no control. The weather. You can't control what the weather's going to be like tomorrow. You might be able to take some precautions in terms of what you think the weather's going to be like, but you can't control the weather itself. There's nothing that you can do that's going to change whether tomorrow it's going to be sunny, whether it's going to rain, whether it's going to snow. You just can't change that. It's not within your control. Wars are not within our control. Now, on a grander scale, perhaps as a nation, you might decide to go to war or not. But the wars themselves, once it's occurring, none of us have control over that. You don't, for example, in our own country today, you don't have control over whether the United States goes to war in Iraq or any other place in the world. You live here, you're a citizen, you can give your input, you can influence how those decisions are made. But once the decision is made, you have no influence either on the fact that we go to war or necessarily the outcome of that war. What about poverty? Again, on an individual basis, you might play your role in trying to eliminate poverty in your small part of the world, but generally speaking, you have no control over poverty in this world. No matter how much you might want justice to occur, no matter how much you might want to remedy poverty and to eliminate it from the face of the earth, in and of yourself, you do not have control over that. Here's a good one. What about other people's attitudes or behavior? Other people's attitudes, including those who are the closest to you in your own home. Can you control the attitude of another? Can you control the behavior of another? Well, you might say as a parent that you might be able to control your child. That's true, but that's still not controlling their attitude. You can't get in their head and make them think a certain way. Same thing with two people who are married. No matter how much you'd like to influence or think that your spouse loves you, and hopefully that's true, but no matter how much that is the case, you are still two unique individuals with your own thoughts and your own way of doing things, and you influence one another, no doubt, but you simply cannot control the other person. And to think that you can is a recipe for disaster and for conflict. And that goes for any relationship, not just a marriage relationship. So we have very little control, if any, over things like that, brethren. But the good news is that we do have control over certain things. Over what do we have control? Well, very important, our own behavior. You can control your own behavior. That you do have control over. Our own attitudes. That you have control over. You can decide what kind of attitude you're going to have. You can decide whether yours is going to be an attitude of worry or anxiety or of trust and confidence in Yahweh. You can decide whether you're going to have a bad attitude about something someone has done to you. In short, we have control over how we react to these other things. So you don't control the weather, but you can control your reaction if it rains on the day of your party. You can decide you're going to cry about it, or you're going to be frustrated and angry about it, or you can decide to move the party indoors. Or in the case of poverty, again, you might not be able to control the overall, but you might decide, I will do my part in my community to reduce poverty. And with war, you might try to influence others to be at peace in some way, shape, or form. So you can control how you react to those things, or you can just decide to accept it and to pray about it and to try to do your part in terms of your spiritual life and your prayer life to see that Yahweh brings the solution in His time. So you have a choice in terms of how you react to those things. That's very significant, brethren. It is very significant. It's not something we consciously think about. We don't consciously walk around thinking, I have the ability to control my attitude or control the way I think. You just kind of naturally do it. And that's what makes it difficult, because depending on how impulsive you are or how patient you are, you're going to react in different ways. But the fact of the matter remains, whether you are an impulsive person on one side or you are a very patient person on the other side, you still have control over how you react to different situations and how you behave as a result of that attitude. One of the ways that we can describe this is describing what I've read in literature as the space, and listen to this carefully, the space between stimulus and response. What is a stimulus? What does it mean to stimulate? To stimulate means to agitate or to make something happen. I'm giving a very broad definition here, but the space between stimulus and response. What do I mean? Well, let me illustrate it visually. So if you imagine my right hand, or less better yet, if you imagine my left hand as being the stimulus, okay, and you imagine my right hand as being the response, let's look at it this way. Here's a stimulus. Someone strikes you across the face in my left hand. And here's the response. You strike them back, right? Or someone gives you a nasty comment, and you give them a nasty comment right back. There's a problem here, brethren. And here it is. You have a space in there. One does not necessarily mean that you have to do the other. If someone comes and gives you a bad word, an unkind word, you don't automatically have to strike them back. That does not have to be your response. Notice that there's, even in the short space I have here, because I'm kind of acting in an impulsive way, there's a space in there. That's what I'm referring to, the stimulus and the response. What I think is a good idea for us, especially in situations where there's trouble or where there could be problems, is to increase that gap. You have a space between the stimulus and the response, which means this does not automatically have to engender this. You can decide within that space how you want to respond. You have the power to do that. You have the power to do that. And I don't care what your culture has taught you. I don't care what your upbringing has taught you. I don't care what you have done 5,000 times in the past. You have the power to change that response. The key is to stop in the middle of that gap, breathe, and think about how you're going to respond. Can we do that? It's something that we need to work on as individuals. Some of us have shorter gaps than others, but we have the space, and we can make the decision how we want to respond. And that's for anything. I'm just giving you some very extreme examples here, but the point of fact is, in any situation that comes up, you have the ability to choose how you're going to respond within that space. To give you a very vivid example, it's the difference between what I call the victim mentality as opposed to someone who takes charge or takes control. The victim, what I mean by victim mentality, first of all, a person who considers themselves a victim, that, you know, the world is out to get them. It's not about what they can do to try to improve their situation. It's, you know, the man is out to get me, or this one's out to get me, or my wife's out to get me, or my children don't love me, or my boss is out to get me, or this one oppresses me, or this is racism, or this is that, or this is this. And there's always some kind of an oppression. And I'm the victim. I'm the passive victim. I can't do anything about this. Or can you? The opposite of being a victim is to be a person who takes charge and takes control of your own life. It doesn't mean that you deny that there's injustice in the world. It doesn't mean that you deny that people sometimes do us harm. It doesn't mean that you deny that there is very real oppression out there. But what it does say is that you have the power to overcome those things regardless of what those oppressions are. So you see, the victim does not realize, whether he or she likes it or not, that the attitude of a victim allows the greatest control by the one who oppresses. Because you give that power to that individual. You say, in effect, when you are a victim, that that person or that thing or that system has the power to oppress you. And I say, if you are not a victim, you are a person who takes charge. You can take charge of that situation to the extent where you can succeed despite the oppression upon you. In other words, you choose your attitude. You can choose to be paranoid, you can choose to remain a victim, or you can choose to take action in your life to bring positive results. The one who acts in spite of adversity succeeds. Not the one who whines, not the one who moans about how unfair the world is. It's a harsh truth, but it's a truth nevertheless. Let's think of some biblical examples here very quickly. Job had the right idea about whether to be, about what kind of attitude he should have. Job 1, beginning with verse 20. Job 1, verse 20. Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshipped. He said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. Yahweh gave, and Yahweh has taken away. Blessed be the name of Yahweh." Through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame Yahweh. That's a wonderful attitude expressed there, brethren. And, of course, we all know the story of Job. And in that first chapter, he lost practically all his family, with the exception of his wife. And he lost a number of other things. And he could have taken that opportunity to say, why is Yahweh picking on me, and you know, the world is against me, and I'm a good person, and instead I'm repaid by Yahweh with evil. And he could have gone on and on in all kinds of directions, but instead he chose a response. He chose a different attitude. Doesn't mean he didn't suffer. Clearly he suffered. It doesn't mean he wasn't in pain. Clearly he was in pain. But yet he understood instinctively that his whining and moaning about it was not going to change that situation. It was done. And he had to accept that reality. And instead, he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. A recognition that everything that he had was given to him by someone else. And that someone was Yahweh. Yahweh gave and Yahweh has taken away. Blessed be the name of Yahweh. Granted, this is not easy to do, brethren. When you are in the midst of pain and suffering, it's not easy to take this kind of attitude, granted. But the whole point here is that here is an example, a living example of someone who did just that. So it can be done. Can we do it, brethren? Can we be strong enough in our own lives when adversity falls? And this is an extreme example, mind you. I'm talking about the day-to-day difficulties and routines that we go through that make life difficult for us. Can we take the attitude that Yahweh gave and Yahweh takes away, and we can accept his will? What about the second chapter? Let's read, beginning with verse 1. Again, there was a day when the sons of Yahweh came to present themselves before Yahweh, and Satan also came among them to present himself before Yahweh. Yahweh said to Satan, where have you come from? Then Satan answered Yahweh and said, from roaming about on the earth and walking around on it. Yahweh said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing Elohim and turning away from evil. Notice the attitude, fearing Elohim and turning away from evil. He made a choice. And he still holds fast his integrity. He made another choice. Although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause. Notice that, to ruin him without cause. An unjust situation. And yet Job chooses to retain his integrity. Satan answered Yahweh and said, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. However, put forth your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh. He will curse you to your face. So Yahweh said to Satan, behold, he is in your power. Only spare his life. Then Satan went out from the presence of Yahweh and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a potsherd to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes. And this is a pretty miserable situation, brethren. Undoubtedly, Job was in terrible pain. Then his wife said to him, verse 9, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse Elohim and die. She made a choice too, didn't she? She made a choice too. This was her. Everyone has a breaking point, brethren. Everyone has a breaking point. You have one, I have one. This woman had reached her breaking point here, but Job didn't. He remained steadfast. He said to her, verse 10, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from Yahweh and not accept adversity? And all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Notice that. He says, shall we indeed accept good from Elohim and not accept adversity? That's tough. That's a difficult saying, brethren. But he made a choice. He chose his attitude, and he was able to remain strong until later his friends came and reminded him how miserable he was. Job's attitude was a good start, but there was something in him in which he fell short. He had a tendency towards self-righteousness. However, Job's strong state of mind and his deep faith in Yahweh, his honesty to eventually acknowledge that he needed an attitude adjustment, resulted in his complete restoration. Yes, he suffered, but he also recognized elements of his own character and nature that needed to change if he was to have a complete relationship with Almighty Yahweh. How about us? We who in reality do not come close to the tribulations that were faced by Job, do we have the strength of character to look deep inside ourselves, as he did, and learn to rely completely on Yahweh? You know, Yahshua had the right idea as well. For lack of time, I won't turn to it, but we've been there before. In Matthew 6, if you want to jot down in your notes, Matthew 6, 25 through 34, where Yahshua comments on an attitude of anxiety and worry versus an attitude of trust in Yahweh and his provisions. This is where he says, you know, behold the lilies of the field, and you know, they don't toil, but yet Yahweh clothes them this way. And he goes on to describe other scenarios where Yahweh provides, even though the one who is receiving that gift or that blessing didn't toil or sweat for those things. Yahweh knows what we need before we even ask him. So it is up to us to choose our attitude. Are we going to choose to be satisfied with what he gives us and not to be anxious or to worry? Or are we going to fret over things that in reality over which we have no control? Let's turn for a final scripture to Philippians 2, because I don't want you to get the impression that I want us only to think about ourselves when we think about attitude. What about your attitude towards others? Philippians 2, and we'll begin reading there with verse 3. And especially as we approach the Holy Days, I would like us to really strongly consider these things. Philippians 2, beginning with verse 3, this is a description, of course, of Yahshua and his mind, which is what we're trying to achieve. Philippians 2, verse 3 says, "Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind," that's the attitude, "but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Messiah Yahshua." And it goes on to describe from there how Yahshua demonstrated that attitude. It's talking about humility, brethren. It's talking about thinking about others. And this is especially important, as I said, as we approach the sacred appointments with our Heavenly Father and His Son. By thinking as a servant and how we can help others, it removes the self-centered, the self-absorbed attitudes that oftentimes get in the way of having a fruitful and fulfilling life. So brethren, as we get closer to this time of year, let us take the time for introspection even now. I know it is difficult to look inside ourselves. However, each one of us, each individual, has the responsibility and the obligation to do so. The truth of the matter is that you may not like what you see, but through the power of Yahweh's Holy Spirit, you do have the ability to do something about it if you find that you need an attitude adjustment, and we all do from time to time. So let us do so diligently. If we each do our part, we will be that much better prepared to enjoy a pleasant and spiritually fulfilling sacred season, and perhaps more important, a pleasant and fulfilling life in Yahshua. So may Yahweh bless you, and may He give you peace.